Thank you. Okay, we have a little bit of a panel here. Nathan, who you've heard already about, who worked on Self, is with us. Nathan John Thompson explores the possibilities of man-machine interaction, mechanical sentience, and the hidden creative corners that arise from these relationships. He's currently artist in residence at Symbiotica on a research grant from the Australian Council for the Arts, researching new technologies in human-based IP stem cell and soft robotics. And we have Schneider TM, who played with Self last night. So Schneider TM is Dirk Dresselhaus. The name Schneider TM comes from his nickname, and so it's a multi-dimensional music project of Dirk's. Since the 80s, Dirk has been active in different musical fields, ranging from adventurous rock and pop bands like Hip Young Things and Locust Fudge, before becoming more active in electronic music in the mid-90s. Schneider TM is responsible for a couple of experimental electro-freak pop albums, including underground hits like Reality Check, Frag Toi, and a cover version of the Smiths' Light 3000 in collaboration with KPT Michigan. Schneider TM has also been credited as one of the main inventors of the music genre Indietronic or Indietronica. And for a while now, Dirk has been moving Schneider TM in the direction of instantly composed freeform music, employing varying instruments like guitar, electronics, balafon, effect loops, as well as field recordings. And last night was really quite amazing. I had the, partially because everyone was crowded around the stage, I took advantage of that and walked around the 16 speakers, each one connected to a different set of electrodes. And the synapses were really crackling. There was a lot of different, also kind of different parts of the array were acting at different times and in kind of rhythms. It was really quite amazing. And I think also some of the team were saying that it was really a quite a special concert. And I was wondering what it was like from the musician's viewpoint.
Hello, 1, 2. For me it was really special as well, because I really had the feeling of communicating with something, and it was less. It's you. Yeah, sorry, but it became something else. So no, anyway. It was much more specific than I expected. It was very musically very interesting, and it was very moving emotionally, I have to say, because I really had the feeling I'm collaborating with, actually it felt like playing with an old friend. Somehow it was really great. In a friendly battle, in a way, and sometimes I really felt challenged by it. Even it started kicking ass at some point when the music was going down, and suddenly like these giant bass waves were coming for a long time, actually producing rhythms like almost African style polyrhythmic Afrobeat. It was very polyrhythmic, so it was very organic and not like a machine really. It really felt like I was thinking about, could it be that there's something like soul inside already or something like that, you know, which is kind of maybe thinking too far, but it felt really, I don't know. I'm still kind of confused and also a little bit scared in a positive way. So, and just today I had the thought, it is somehow the inverted concept of a band like Kraftwerk, who are like humans trying to play like machines. So this is like a machine basically trying to not, maybe not play like human, but maybe trying. I don't know. So, I don't. I mean, there's no consciousness yet. But it was a really extraordinary experience, I have to say. Yeah.
One of the things that I really was interested to hear when you talk about it is the fact that it was a little bit scary. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, because it felt like there's someone there, which or there's that. It certainly felt like there's an element involved that is not only technology. I also play a lot with like modular systems, and which have like random runglers or something, random modules cross-modulating themselves, and you have something like randomness. It really didn't feel like randomness, although if you work with modular systems like that, you want actually randomness to create chance, and through this aspect of chance there's like interesting musical moments happening, which of course is there also involved, I guess, because of it's a patched quite complex modular synthesizer, but you don't have a feeling of a collaboration with a pure machine. With self, I really had the feeling there is a communication happening somehow. And that was very moving and also a little bit scary, and certainly something I didn't expect in that intensity. I thought it would be a little bit more fake, actually. But it's not.
The idea that you feel as though it's an old kind of friend, yeah, is really, really interesting to me. Some kind of connection, perhaps, with something that's older than, of course, our relationship, which has only started yesterday or the day before, but something that actually has a connection much deeper and further than human language itself. Where the idea for the sound being produced in response to movement. Historically, I think the way that we've produced sound as humans has been in response to the environment that we're in. And I think that's something that's really basic to our human existence. Perhaps the feelings that you felt are a connection to a history that's older than the music that's being produced now, and older than the languages that we're speaking at this point in time.
I mean, the DNA inside self is much older than humanity itself.
For sure, for sure. So
I think when we were talking earlier, we came, or in another conversation, talk about a neural noise as one of the origins, maybe, of the idea that the neuroscientists were looking at the communication between neurons, and then came up with this phrase neural noise, just to do the electronic communication. And you know, something we've been coming up with other angles, like for even from non-human and non-eukaryote cells, like bacteria. You know, I think science has seen them as individual cells, single-celled creatures, but they tend to form colonies, communities, you could say, and they communicate for quorum chemically through quorum sensing. And here you have not individual cells, but colony of cell that communicate through electricity. And so there is certainly an agency in that communication. I mean, they communicate for a purpose. So, you know, I don't know if we can't talk of consciousness, perhaps, but certainly there's agency even within this small colony of 100,000. So they're obviously acting and reacting to the input. So I would say we have, if quorum sensing is an act of bacterial communication here, we have an act of complex human and human cell neuron communication.
I think that in that level, it's, again, I don't think that we can talk about consciousness or intelligence, but yeah, communication for sure. And I think that in that level, we can maybe start thinking about calculations. So I think that those neural networks may be, they could possibly look at calculating problems and or with their response kind of using some sort of calculations mechanisms. And you can, there's a few papers that kind of show that this is what they do. There are some scientists that are using higher resolution arrays, so 25,000 arrays on a smaller kind of area. And this is where it's much easier to kind of see exactly what they're doing and how they're in each one of the individual neurons can influence the rest of the network. And you can show that, you know, if you stimulate in one area of the dish, quite a lot of calculations are kind of done at the north, you know, far away, and how the signals, you can actually follow with those arrays the signals and what is happening once this is kind of working. So I think that it's kind of a higher... I think that there's kind of a higher level of communication than kind of the, well, I don't know if higher, but there is definitely some sort of a communication between kind of the bits and pieces of the network. What I was interested that, well, one of the things that Schneider said that it's interesting is that, you know, when it comes to randomness, I talked to a lot of scientists that claim that, well, that perceive the neural activity in that level quite random. But I don't really agree with them. You know, I mean, there's a lot of other, you know, there's a lot of, there's other kind of scientists or literature that claims that there is something there. And I do believe that it's more than just a number, random number generator. And again, I mean, in the talk I was talking about the fact that I feel that, and I can't really explain it, there's some sort of vitalism there, yeah. Secular vitalism, of course.
Yeah, but what is not random, I think, is the fact that if the cells are getting stimulated by outside sound and react in whatever way, and I'm also reacting to what it produces, so it produces like a ring modulation, which is then not so random because it is communication, yeah. Basically, like feedback with basic feedback with a guitar in front of an amp is not random because it is actually controlled by the circumstances.
Yeah, I think that what was really interesting in your show, and we didn't really see it in previous shows, we saw it in a few others, but not all of them, is, and this is what I was more interested in, rather than the responsiveness, I was more interested in what happens over time. And, you know, we always kind of say that the sound of the synthesizer, it's like color, the audio color, it's less interesting to me personally. What I am more interested in is the behavior of the neurons that is manifested through sound. And through your performance, I think that it was very clear that it was some sort of a development. And I thought that was quite interesting.
I just want to pick up one thing. I think when talking about scientists and their use of terminology, when Guy mentioned that the random aspect of the way scientists see the activity, and also the terminology they use for neuronal noise, I guess us as artists working in biological labs where we're tackling things from a different perspective, and the idea of claiming that something is neuronal noise is just a word that is used in order to put a title on something they don't understand. So it's really good as an artist to work with these kind of systems and actually try and talk about how we can create more vocabulary around things outside of the scientific context. And it's really great to hear Schneider's words that really resonate. And Jan also has talked about self. It's really great to hear people that aren't necessarily so ingrained as the team is with self produce or elicit words and conversations around the work that are quite deep, that we didn't expect, that would come across just from one performance, or actually even experiencing it just for one day. We're quite happy to hear these things, because we thought it would only be us that actually experienced this thing. That's great.
But with noise, it's interesting because, you know, I mean, the nightmare of the engineers is noise. And this is the nightmare, you know, and this is what we welcome. We're looking for the noise. We're kind of really happy to take on board this nightmare and, you know, work with it. This is where it becomes interesting for us.
There's organized noise and chaotic noise.
Well, this is what Andrew did his PhD on, didn't he?
Yes, Andrew. He's got a PhD in chaos. he's a Dr. Chaos.
So it was also interesting in the run-up, there were a couple reactions. One was on, I think, on a posting where somebody said, oh, analog, you know, why, you know, everyone's trying to skip digital, and, you know, and I was kind of writing back on it. It was like, well, actually, you know, the electrons produce electric connections, so why would you translate that and then translate it back if you can run it directly into an analog synthesizer? But it also was thinking of in the interview we did for the website here, Hakave website, the question you jumped over, which is the kind of transhumanist, there was some, I would call it the technosphere question, because it has this idea of the you know, the technology and the biology coming together, the digital and the biological. And I think we're both very skeptical about that. I think they take different viewpoints. The engineers always want to, the engineering mentality, it's from Occam's razor, this idea of simplicity is better, and biology is 3.5 billion years of increasing complexity for the sake of survival. So I think there's like a disconnect there. But it was interesting here to see, you know, like a very small colony comparatively, 1/1,000,000th of the size of a brain. And yet there's, you know, there's, and only 64 out of the 100,000, you know.
Yeah,
so there's a very small part, but, you know, so of the complexity. But at least, you know, taking this on to this degree of, trying it. And also I would say there's so much in the work that's beyond understanding.
But, you know, I mean, we have to also remember that we are helping this little network. I mean, this network is quite simple. I mean, it's very complex, but it's quite simple. We are helping them with a lot of decisions that we are making on the way. And that's mainly kind of the patching, yeah? Things that are probably could, if we would go with 1-to-1 ratio, you know, just kind of go beep when there's an action potential, you know, we, from a sound point of view, we may, you know, we could get a really simple and very boring kind of outcome. So, you know, we do, and, you know, we should not ignore the fact that we are providing a lot of color and, you know, kind of layers of complexity through the analog modular synthesizers. And this is what we always say. We're not listening to the neurons. The neurons are not making the sound. The neurons are just controlling the synthesizers the way humans would control analog modular synthesizers, by providing CV signals to kind of different components. So I guess that I just said, because it is important to kind of remember that quite a lot of the complexity as we hear it is done through the analog modular synthesizers, but the core control of it, well, not the core, but the control of those synthesizers is made by the neural networks. And, you know, when we started develop the project, we had so many discussions with, mainly with Darren, because he was doing the patching on how much abstraction of data do we want. And, you know, the answer was kind of in the middle. You know, we don't want a 1-to-1 signal, because, you know, it would be a very boring project this way, from a sound point of view, but we still don't want to lose. On the other hand, we don't want to lose what the neurons are doing.
Maybe this is a good point to take to move over to the audience to see if I'm sure there are some questions out there. There's someone with a microphone, so they'll come around, I guess, start back there.
Yes, I have a question.
Just a moment, the microphone's just behind you.
Hello. It's a very interesting project, and my question is, would it sound different if you used another person's cells?
I don't really think so. I would like to believe that mine would play much better. So, yes. No, I don't think so. I think that my, in that kind of level, in that kind of, because, you know, I mean, when you ask this thing, you kind of, you forget things to do with consciousness, intelligence, soul, vitalism, who you are, yeah? And it's beyond kind of this immediate neural network or the actual cells. I think that it would be very, very similar. But you have to remember that every single culture that I make, and we have 20 external brains or 20 cultures here in an incubator in the house, if you put each one of them, they would sound differently. You know, they don't do exactly the same thing. So I don't think that there's going to always be a difference between what the cultures that you put in the rig, but I don't think that other people's cultures, even if they're musicians or whatever they are, would sound better or worse or would perform better or worse. That comes down to kind of how you culture them and how much you what sort of treatment you give them. It would be better if the cultures that we play with are 12 days old. It could have been much better if it was 25 days old, because you let the cultures mature and the neurons to kind of, you know, the networks to be more complex. But you know, we couldn't do it because of time limits. Yeah, we can't really come a month before shows and just stay and wait for the neurons to grow. So we're really using the minimum time that we have. So the short answer is no, I don't think so.
In many ways, I think it's the network that would probably have an impact on the different sounds that we're hearing. So, as Guy mentioned, with time, the network probably, depending on the stimulations that it's receiving, will change, and as a result, what is heard would change. One of the things about the device is that we can actually, when self is not on the road, we can disconnect the main core part of the incubator and synth outside of the large device and put it in a lab and use it for more or less learning about our own processes, but also use it to learn about what can happen with long-term stimulation. And one of the things that I'm really interested about, perhaps if we bring it back to the lab in Perth soon enough, I'd like to get some of Guy's cells and plate them in there and play some Britney Spears to it for, say, 2 or 3 weeks to see how that changes the neural plasticity of Guy's neurons.
If they survive.
Yes.
You run that by an ethics panel?
Yes. Or play it music that Guy likes. All these kind of investigations are really interesting, and I think that will have an effect on the outcome.
But I think that in that level, it's what's, you know, if I may kind of put it in other words, one of the questions that we're very, very interested in, whether it's Britney Spears or whatever, David Bowie, we are really, and this is why in every performance we invite different musicians to play with self. You know, the kind of $1 million question that he's probably would that probably would stay unanswered because we're not performing a scientific experiment. We don't collect data in a scientific way. We just have observations. Is whether different musicians and different approaches to music, different ensembles, would affect the functional plasticity of those cultures in a different way. And in order to do that, we need, as Nathan said, a more, much more controlled environment, the lab, but also we need to kind of keep stimulating them over quite a lot of time and kind of look at the changes and then compare. We can't do it in performances.
Okay, there's a question over, or maybe just because just have space for the person walking, maybe for Evelina. then next be right here.
So thank you very much. It's a fascinating project, and it's very helpful to know some background about it, because when you just hear the performance, it's very hard to tell who's controlling the synthesizer and how does it differ if the cells control it or if a person controls it. But as I understood, you stimulate the cells. Is it correct? So you send signals to the cells. You not only pick up their signals. So there was this electroshock therapy in the 60s where humans were treated with electrical signals to erase bad memories or to cure mental diseases. So when you are sending signals to your cells, are you overstimulating them? Do you really send them higher signals? Do they have a chance not to respond and to ignore you?
I mean, the signals that we send them are very similar to the stimulations that you get, that your brain is, you know, when we talk and when you see things, your brain is constantly stimulated through kind of electric signals that is kind of sent to various kind of areas of your brain, you know, with the nervous system. And it's a very similar thing. We're sending stimulations that would stimulate the cells rather than kill the cells. Maybe in some of the prototypes, we did kill a few prototypes.
Yes, we went up to about 10 volts.
Yeah, exactly.
And that did actually erase a lot of the activity.
Well, it killed them. So, you know, we make sure that the stimulations that we send the cells are in microvolts, and what they do is they stimulate the network rather than affect them in a negative way, such as killing or, you know, erase memory means basically breaking up those connections that the neural network has. So really, we're not doing that. What was the second half of your question?
I didn't ask it yet, but I do have it.
No, but you asked another thing, whether they kill them or can...
No, I just ask what kind of, what is the level of signals you're sending them, and if it's really in the spectrum where they can just ignore it.
And okay, that was the one. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if ignore is the right word, because, again, I mean, they don't really have a choice. They sit on an electrode that sends them those stimulations, but not always. You know, it's not given that every neuron within the network would respond to those stimulations. So those are kind of, we don't know, you know, I mean, and this is what we told Schneider yesterday. He came to the sound check a day before to listen to it, and we told him that we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And we did have really quiet performances where, you know, the neural network was not really active. And, you know, in one of the shows in Mona, when Scott Tinkler was playing the trumpet, and you know, he's a great player, and in the first 10 minutes, he was just playing, and really, we didn't get a lot of results, which was quite hard on Scott, but, you know, over time, we started to get a little bit more responses, but neurons can or cannot respond to those stimulations. Theoretically, they will eventually. Yeah, it's not a given that all neurons in the network would do something or produce electric activity. I mean, you can use other stimulators to get the activity go, like dopamine, etc., for instance, different kind of chemicals, but in this project, we're not using them.
And a very brief second question. You mentioned that the cells have a lifespan. So this colony that you're growing, do they all come from the same batch of cells, or they die and you have new colonies? And do they have kind of genetic memory between them?
No, I don't think so. Well, the gene, the genetic makeup of those cells.
Well, epigenetic, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I mean, what happens is that I grew stem cells in Barcelona, as I mentioned, and then I pushed them down the neuronal lineage, and I stopped this differentiation process when they become neural NSCs, neural stem cells. So there are still stem cells that already made the choice to become neurons, yeah? But not neurons, neuronal cells, because there are different type of cells then that they can differentiate to. And at this point, I froze them. And then I have quite a lot of stock of those neural stem cells in the freezer, in Symbiotica, in the liquid nitrogen, actually. And every time that we perform, we take one vial and or a couple of vials. We ship it. We shipped a couple of vials here to Berlin, and then we start the differentiation just before the show. And at day 12, we perform with them. So I don't really believe that there's a memory between those cultures, but they all come from the same source. But we have multiple. If you can imagine that we have multiple batches and passages, and you know, there's, you know, because we when we multiply those neural stem cells. In the lab, when you grow them, you can just, neural stem cells as opposed to neurons divide. So you can actually grow them, grow 1 million cells and get billions of cells at the end. But you do it in different steps and you have different batches. So they're kind of different a little bit, but they're all from the same source. And I don't believe that they have this kind of memory that you talk about. The interesting thing about neurons is that you can, they don't proliferate. And therefore, you can grow them for a long, long time. So, you know, in one of the scientists that I worked with grew a neuronal culture for more than a year or a year and a half. He maintained the same culture over and over and over. And that's kind of an interesting thing to look what happens to the this network over time, because the more mature the network becomes, the more complex it becomes, the neural activity, not the individual activity of all the neurons within the network, but the way they work in concert, the synergy between them increases and becomes a bit more interesting.
Sadly, we can't take these cells that Schneider has stimulated back home with us. So I think we'll have to kind of dispose of them before we leave.
You can say the word kill.
Can I? Okay, sorry. That gets a lot of bad reactions, but... Yes, we will kill the cells before returning home to Australia.
Yeah. Okay, there's a question over here.
May I go here? Sorry.
Thank you. It is a very interesting project, and you kind of answered a little bit some of the questions that I had. One of them is, what exactly is the signal that gets sent to the cells? You talked about how it's a micro, in the microvolt level, and what kind of filtering and processing happens? Is it just straight up the sound to, is just filtered down to microvolts?
I'll take you through the process, more or less, what's happening from the human musician. We have the human musician, of course, responding to what they're hearing being made. The human musician is producing sound of various frequencies and changes over the time. We have self listening to these frequencies. We have the ability to take out parts of the frequencies that these artists are producing. We can control across a large spectrum of where these frequencies will be sending a trigger. So the artist, the human artist, is able to shape, if they like, what they're producing in a frequency kind of realm, in order to produce spikes of stimulation. But then we have the ability to take these stimulations at these particular frequencies and place them anywhere within the dish, along what Guy showed earlier, the 16 parts of the dish. So in a way, the composition that the human musician is producing in an improvisationary way is stimulating certain parts of the network on the fly. Perhaps your question was kind of aimed towards the idea of control. We can communicate more about that. But the spectrum of control of where we're deciding and who's deciding is part of this work. And this is the conversations that we want to have.
So the choice of which frequencies and which parts of the network get stimulated, these are conversations that you have with the musicians before each performance. Is it something that the performers are involved in, or is it something that you as the team, the self-team, decides?
Some performers want to have this conversation. Some performers prefer to not be involved. We make decisions dependent on the situation that we have. Some musicians really would like to nut it out, but it's also an aspect of time. And one of the great things that comes out of this project, we work with fantastic artists that are able to improvise and take on the role in this machine feedback loop. And that's what I think is interesting, rather than the idea of trying to nut out the minute nuts and bolts of everything. The idea for us to all sit back and actually watch it perform in real time is interesting. And having a local musician that is familiar with the people in the place, the architecture of the room itself, the lab where the cells are made, all of these things are along this spectrum of control. But once the performance starts, it's something that's out of our hands, even more or less out of the performer's hands, and they just have to roll with it, and that's what's beautiful.
Yeah. I just want to add to what Nathan said. I mean, before Nathan designed, Nathan was the one that designed with Andrew this module that accepts and analyzes the human musician. I mean, we had the discussions about, we kind of observed how improvisers play on stage, you know, jazz musicians, for instance, where, you know, they play without kind of any written or kind of script, yeah? But they have quite a lot of visual cues and audio cues between them. And we thought that it would be good to give the human musicians the ability to give cues, you know, the same cues through stimulations to the neurons. And therefore, we developed this model that allows the musician to control more or less. You know, it's a bit dirtier than it sounds, to be able to communicate. And for me personally, this is the most important module of this piece, because I'm really interested in the human non-human communication. And this module allows for it to actually occur.
Since I have the microphone, I have just one more thing. She walked so far to bring it here. As far as stimulating the cells in preparation for the performances, you seem to be on this 12-day limit because of touring. What kind of stimulation do you give them, and what's the oldest cell culture that you were able to perform with?
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things I'm really proud of is that I developed by myself a protocol in the lab to, you know, kick those cultures in the butt so they perform faster. So there's the kind of basic protocol that I kind of took from the literature. And then there's the growth hormones. And, you know, there's a list of kind of 12 growth hormones, and I had them in the lab, and I had the growth hormones, and I said, okay, this is really interesting. Let's start playing with them. And I started to just throw them and have random combination between them. And really, I didn't do it in a scientific way. I didn't really write what I do. I just kind of tried stuff. And I don't think that I tried it all, but I got to the point where it worked for me and said, well, this is the Guy Benauri recipe, which I'm very proud of. I use growth hormones to enhance and kind of accelerate their maturity. I can tell you what they are: BDNF, NGE3, and NGF. And another thing that I kind of use to accelerate their production of action potentials is called is a chemical. It's an amino acid that is called CAMP. So this is, I don't know if you're a scientist or not, but this is what I use in the lab. And the oldest culture that we used was in the first performance in Perth, just because our lab, Symbiotica, is there. And the performance was on campus. You know, it was 5 minutes away. So we didn't need to kind of travel, and we didn't need to kind of thaw the cells and, you know, go through this kind of process. So we had a culture that was 21 days old, and it was really active, and it was really good to kind of play with that. But, you know, I mean, we can't really afford coming 30 days before, because you need to thaw the neural stem cells and then let them grow. And before you start differentiating them, you have probably 4 days that you need to do some work. You know, I have a family that I really like, love, and I have a job, a day job, so I can't really go for a long time away.
To take Nathan's idea, but maybe mix it with a live musician, have you done it maybe with Darren or someone else where they've musicians played repeatedly with the same colony, maybe, you know, like every, once an hour a day, 5 days or something, to see if there's a relationship of sorts built or plasticity increases to the level that it gets more, more sophisticated?
I mean, I wish we could do it, you know. I mean, this is exactly what Nathan was talking about before, but Darren lives in Tokyo. And again, I mean, Nathan and myself are active in kind of research, and we're working on our next project, or we're kind of working on our next couple of more projects. And, you know, we could really spend all our lives working on self, but there's a limit to what we are willing to put there. We have other ideas that we really want to pursue. So I think that the research into self is kind of, unless something would happen and we would have more time because of job and money and things like that, the research into self is done, and we're performing with that now. And what we're trying to do is to collect the recordings from those performances and just look at them and kind of try to figure out what is happening from them. But, you know, we can improve the protocols, and we can improve quite a lot of things, and we can look at relationships and kind of what happens in the end. But you know what? I'm actually really happy to leave it with a question mark and leave it without an answer, because, you know, I mean, I'm not a scientist. I don't actually look for data as much of kind of creating scenarios and asking those questions and, you know, leaving it in the blurry area sometimes is relieving and empowering.
It'd be nice to have Schneider come to Perth and actually play in our lab for a long set of 12 hours every
month.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Run, Schneider.
Just call me, I'll be there.
Get a grant.
Perfect thing to do.
Maybe
in Berlin,
we do
get
like
away from
a 10 CD box or something.
It's a perfect, perfect thing to do next. Perfect thing to do next January to get away from the Berlin winter.
Yeah, January in Perth is fantastic.
Okay.
So that is indeed a very exciting project. Thank you very much. I have a very general question. What were the biggest engineering challenges that you had to overcome while designing it?
This is a very interesting question because I think, you know, we're seven people that were involved in the development of this project. And I think that if you ask each one of us, you'll get seven different answers. So there's two people here and there's one over there if he wants to talk. But for me, it was optimizing the protocols and getting those damn neurons to grow on the interface. It was a nightmare. It took me 18 months, and I have to say that probably when I got to the 12 month without success, I almost gave up. So that was my nightmare. What was your Nathan?
There have been so many. So many. It's difficult for me to actually pinpoint one because I'm not sure where I actually sit within this project, and I can't pinpoint one kind of place where I've worked on more intently than the others. But I was brought into the project as basically the designer. And
he was naive. He thought that he's only a designer.
Yes. The engineering issues around making it a mobile lab were significant, and I thought that it would be easy when I took on this position. The incubator at the front remarkably came together quite quickly. We had people nearby at Symbiotica that could help at the time. And that being said, I think it's the first, perhaps, artwork that I know of that has a custom-made CO2 incubator for mammalian cells. But by far the most stressful part of this whole project is, funnily enough, the thing that we're not using. and that's the Class 1 sterile hood at the back. We're not using it today and here in Berlin because we're able to use the lab here. But to have a sterile environment to feed the cells in field conditions was part of the design brief of this work for obvious reasons. And when dealing with airflow, a thing that you can't see, you have to create inside a sterile hood, you have to create an environment that is slightly negative pressure, but not so negative where the outside air is contaminating your work. There has to be a curtain of air on the inside that protects the person working with it from the biological matter, and also protects the biological matter from contamination from the outside world. The mechanics behind it is kind of really obscure, and air flows and things like that, it's a black art. And I'm happy that we have an artwork that has a sterile hood in it that functions. But it wasn't done easily. It was, I think, 8 months of stress to actually get it working. Just that one piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, it's working. I'm very aware that we're not like listening to the neurons, but listening to the patches of the synthesizer. I was wondering if you change them a lot between performances, or you try to keep them kind of similar so you can more easily hear the difference that the stimulation or the live musicians make to what the synthesizer is getting out. So do you use completely different patches every performance or very similar ones?
I think it depends and it changes every place we play. In Sydney, we had the same dish over three nights with three different groups of performers. The patching of the synth changed every day, but we used the same dish because this project is still quite young, we're still trying to find really how we navigate and using this whole, you know, system. So it did change in the patches per day in Sydney. In Hobart, over the 3 days, we used a different dish. But I think we used similar patches. They were just tweaked during the day. And again, it was different. So it's difficult for me to put a finger on where the change was, because both of those times we've done something different. And again, today we're using a different dish to yesterday, but I'm not sure Darren's now there, so I don't know what he's doing.
Basically, we're employing non-scientific methods to reveal scientific questions, which we're kind of adding some chaos to that. I mean, we don't have lab books as well. You know, we just try to remember what we're doing.
Maybe if there's one more question from the audience. Flo?
Hi. First, thanks a lot, because it's a really amazing project. And I was wondering, like, what kind of type of neurons you were using. And there was this cellular memory topic that was kind of mentioned between the lines before. And I was wondering if you would consider using other type of cells, like, for example, cardiac pacemaker cells. Would they act like a music conductor, maybe?
The neurons, the protocol that we use to differentiate the neurons is non-specific. So, again, I'm not a scientist. I can see here a few scientists that can maybe help me. But the networks that of neurons that we have in the dishes are, it's a mixed culture. So you can't really say what they are. There's probably different types of neurons there. But they work, so we didn't kind of bother to check exactly what, I think that every dish would kind of have different, if you look at the concentrations of exactly what neurons, the percentage of each type of neurons would change. As far as cardiac myocytes, no, we're not going to use cardiomyocytes for self, because it is such a complex project, and it's, adding layers and layers and kind of trying other things is, I don't think that it's relevant to self. Self is a work that is based on the idea that kind of disembodied brains, quote unquote, control and modular synthesizers to be able to play and jam with human musicians, and it's kind of looking at the human and non-human communication. On the other hand, Nathan and myself are working on a new project that involves cardiomyocytes, because they're quite amazing type of cells, but it's under development, and I'm not really sure if this is the time that we need to reveal all our secrets.
Okay, thank you. I think we're getting towards a time where we switch panels. And so first, a round of applause for Guy, for Nathan, for Schneider.